And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. I'd like to let you know that this is Thursday, April 7th, and it would be a good idea for you to have pencil and paper handy so that you can write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, any of that action that you will need to take action. Let's start with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Santa Cruz County Chapter is having a habitat restoration this Saturday, April 9th. And there's a special time this week, and they will start at 9 a.m. instead of their normal 10 a.m. And they will be at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. We have made significant dents in removing invasive non-native French broom from Quail Hollow. Many unique and rare species of flora and fauna eke out an existence found only on the sandhills habitat of Quail Hollow. After restoration, be sure to stop by for the spring native plant sale. How to get to Quail Hollow? Well, go up Graham Hill Road from Santa Cruz. As you come down into Felton, turn right on East Ziani Road and drive 2 miles up and turn left on Quail Hollow Road. Half a mile up on the right is the park entrance. Meet them in the parking lot on the left-hand side of the entrance road. And once again, that will be at 9 a.m. this weekend, April 9th on Saturday. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Please wear comfortable layered clothing and bring something to drink and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, and it might just rain a little bit on Saturday. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring your gloves and your water. For more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. You could email her at redwoodrn, that's R-E-D-W-D-R-N, at pacbell.net. Or visit the webpage at www.cruisecnps.org. Alameda Creek Volunteer Earth Day Restoration in Niles, California will take place on April 17th. Join us for a morning of habitat restoration along Alameda Creek in Niles, California to celebrate Earth Day on Sunday, April 17th from 10 a.m. to noon. We'll focus on removing invasive ivy and on maintaining the native plants our volunteers put in the ground at Niles Adopt-A-Spot earlier this year. Your efforts will continue past work by volunteers and enhance habitat for fish and wildlife along Alameda Creek for years to come. Meet at 10 a.m. at the Niles Staging Parking Area along Old Canyon Road near Canyon Oaks Court in the Niles area of Fremont. The address is approximately 720 Old Canyon Road. They'll work until about noon. You need to RSVP, so please go to their website. Wear long pants and sturdy closed-toe shoes that can get dirty. Please no sandals or flip-flops. They provide tools and gloves. The work isn't on much of a slope, but the ground can be uneven. There is no poison oak in the immediate area where we'll be working. Expect cool weather and morning dew when we start. Heavy rain cancels. All participants need to have a signed waiver form, and you can go to the website for details, and anyone under 18 needs a parental signature. You do need to RSVP and fill out those signed waiver forms on the website of www.alamedacreek.org. That's www.alamedacreek.org. And once again, their volunteer restoration day is April 17th from 10 to noon at the Niles staging area on Old Canyon Road in Niles, California. The Elliott Rainforest Climbing Camp will be held April 19th through the 24th in Oregon. If you need more information about this event, which we've publicized before, please send an email to ElliottClimbCamp2K16@gmail.com. That's ElliottClimbCamp2K16@gmail.com, or you could go to the earthfirst.org/newswire site. where the article is posted. Four people have been arrested in Colorado for sabotaging a genetically modified cannabis crop in this story from the Earth First Newswire. Four activists were apprehended in their Denver homes and charged with uprooting crops of genetically engineered cannabis during two late-night actions. The crop destruction took place over the course of two separate nights in early January when individuals pulled up 6,500 genetically engineered marijuana plants on a pair of privately owned plots of land leased and managed by Syngenta. The first act of what the FBI considers economic sabotage and a violation of federal law involving damage to commercial agricultural enterprises took place during the night of January 4th, when about 1,000 weed plants on one property were uprooted. Three nights later, the destruction continued on another property where another 5,500 pot plants were destroyed. Colorado Commissioner of Agriculture Don Brown issued a statement about the acts of sabotage, quoting, "To my knowledge, this is the first time someone has deliberately taken the cowardly step of uprooting high-value plants growing in our state. Regardless of how one feels about marijuana, bioengineered or not, there is no justification for committing these crimes, and it is not the kind of behavior we expect to see in Colorado agriculture," unquote, Brown said. The United States has recently seen a widespread cultural and legal shift in favor of medical marijuana, and the states of Washington, Colorado, Oregon, and Alaska are the first to have legalized the plant for recreational use. This is a huge win for those who previously didn't have access to the medicine they needed, and will also keep future pot smokers out of prison. However, many stoners have feared that the plant's shove into the spotlight will result in an increased scale of production, widespread use of industrial techniques, and genetic tampering, a fear that's been actualized with Syngenta's first plots of test crops. Fortunately, this recent case of GMO cannabis sabotage demonstrates that activists concerned about the integrity of the natural world, including the drugs we grow, are willing to risk their freedom to take action. According to authorities, the four activists didn't seem to have a special knowledge or tools that allowed them to carry out the act, but they were still able to cause massive damage to the test plots. It looked like people entered the field on foot and destroyed the plants by hand, said Paul Meinhardt, head of corporate communications in North America for Syngenta, a global agricultural corporation based in Switzerland that is engineering the cannabis plants to have increased cold tolerance, enabling commercial weed farming to take place in a wider range of climates. Our Skywalker OG could maintain dense buds with dank crystals at temperatures far below what most non-GMO marijuana crops can handle, added Guy Fontaine, manager of Syngenta's Colorado plots. To say this is a bummer would be an understatement. Estimates for the damage were not specified, but the financial losses are significant, according to FBI spokesperson Beth Ann Steele. Though not yet being sold commercially or approved for recreational or medical consumption, the success of these test plots is a vital step in increasing profits from the rapidly expanding cannabis industry, as well as engineering a genetically engineered superhigh. This is not the first act of sabotage against genetically modified organism crops in the U.S. More than a decade ago, environmental saboteurs vandalized experimental crops across the country in a revolt against high-tech agriculture. Foes of genetic engineering also struck in the year 2000 when members of the Earth Liberation Front set fire to agriculture offices at Michigan State University. ELF's position was that genetic engineering was, quote, one of the many threats to the natural world as we know it, unquote. April 20th, also known as 420 Stoner Christmas and Thanksgiving, is coming up fast in weed hotspots like Boulder, Colorado and Santa Cruz, California. Smokers traditionally gather in public places to smoke in protest of laws that make the plant illegal. Now that these once-a-year activists have realized their dreams of legalization in many parts of the country, can we expect to see them out in the streets again this year, fighting against genetically engineered Mary Jane and for the integrity of the plant they love? Or will they prove themselves to be stay-at-home stoners, waking and baking worry-free while the corporations slowly strangle out the wild of their plant ally? And this story was found on the earthfirstjournal.org newswire. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. We have great news. Year-round habitat on Horse Butte has been approved. In January, Governor Steve Bullock issued his decision to grant year-round habitat for wild buffalo on Horse Butte and other lands north and west of Yellowstone. This decision had to be approved by the Interagency Bison Management Plan decision makers. And at yesterday's IBMP meeting, there was full consensus to accept the governor's decision. This is a profound victory for wild buffalo, something the Buffalo Field Campaign has been fighting for nearly 20 years, and we could not have achieved this without you. The decision will go into effect this spring, so all the buffalo who are now heading to their Horse Butte calving grounds should be able to give birth and raise their babies in peace. It's not a perfect decision, as there are some lands that the buffalo use which have now been taken away, and there are some population caps for the number of buffalo that can inhabit Horse Butte during different seasons, but it is an awesome first step. We will continue to press for more buffalo on a much larger landscape, but for now, please celebrate this significant victory and think about all the baby buffalo and their moms and families who will be able to live in peace and make their own choices for the first time in over 100 years. We also want to thank you very, very, very much for responding to our call last week to help us purchase new Buffalo on the Road signs. You came through within a single day. You are also amazing. Thank you. We have ordered our new signs, and they should be here sometime next week. Our patrols are extremely busy on the highways right now, morning into the very late hours of night, warning traffic and trying to prevent buffalo from being hit. We receive terrific positive feedback from the community and other wildlife advocates because we are making a big difference. Even so, it is not enough. As we have said, there are some people who just don't heed the warnings. Last night, despite our signs, another buffalo was hit and killed. It is imperative that we pressure Montana to implement safe passage infrastructure, overpasses and underpasses, so wildlife can move safely through their migration corridors without ever having to step foot on the highways. Please take action at our website on this important issue. In Gardner, things have really calmed down. Yellowstone's trap was closed for the rest of the season last Thursday, with the Yosemite National Park falling short of their kill target by 300 buffalo. 57 calves and yearlings will remain in the trap until Yellowstone makes its decision on an operational quarantine or domestication plan. Yellowstone states that they are still sifting through the public comments they received, and it is unknown when they will make a decision. Outside of the trap, most of the buffalo have headed deeper south into the park's interior to their calving grounds on Blacktail Plateau and the Lamar Valley. In fact, buffalo calving season has already begun there. A photographer friend who was leading a wildlife tour spotted the first calf of the season in the lower Lamar Valley just a few days ago. The next generation of wild buffalo is on the way. Please visit their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign, for a lot of information about what the Buffalo Field Campaign is and what they need. And when you figure that out, go to Buffalo Field, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call at 406-646-0070. And you can find all this information and more at their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. Please remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And a pact has been reached to remove 4 Klamath River dams that block salmon migration in this story by Bettina Boxall of the Los Angeles Times. California, Oregon, and a private utility Wednesday signed an agreement that could finally take down 4 hydroelectric dams that block salmon migrations on the Klamath River in Northern California and Oregon. The pact, signed by the governors of both states and federal officials at the mouth of the Klamath in Northern California, spells out a roadmap for pursuing the dam's demolition without congressional approval. It amends part of a complicated 2010 pact that gave the U.S. Interior Department a major role in decommissioning and required Congress to sign off on the removal. However, Congress failed to act on authorized legislation by last year's deadline, which threw the deal into limbo. The new version eliminates direct federal involvement, sidestepping the need for congressional authorization. This historic agreement will enable Oregon and California and the interested parties to get these 4 dams finally removed and the Klamath River restored to its pristine beauty, Governor Jerry Brown of California said. Under the amendment, Pacific Corps, a private utility that owns the dams, will transfer title and license to a recently created nonprofit that will seek permission from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to remove the dams by the year 2020. Funding outlined in the original will contribute up to $250 million in state bond money and a surcharge on Pacific Core customers in Oregon and Northern California will provide another $200 million. That would cover the estimated decommissioning costs of $300 million. The new organization called the Klamath River Renewal Corps will manage the decommission process and also assume liability for any problems associated with the removal. Originally backed by many tribal farming and fishing interests in the Klamath Basin, the agreements ran into opposition on a variety of fronts. Some conservationists complained that the pact gave too much water to irrigators and not enough to fish. California's Siskiyou County, where three of the dams are located, fought the loss of property taxes and a power source. Representative Doug Malfalfa, a farmer and Richfield Republican who represents much of Northern California, complained Wednesday that state and federal officials had made an end run around Congress. He stated, "The overwhelming majority of residents in the Klamath Basin, those who are actually impacted, have been cut out of this process in favor of environmental extremists, bureaucrats in Sacramento and Washington, and a taxpayer bailout for billionaire Warren Buffett," LaMalfa said in a statement. Part of Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway Incorporation empire, Pacific Core has portrayed the dismantling as a prudent business decision. To meet federal relicensing requirements for the aging dams, the company said it would have had to spend $400 million on fish ladders and water quality improvements. Under a second agreement signed on Wednesday, federal officials promised to help Upper Klamath Basin irrigators adjust to the arrival of the salmon, which are under federal legal protection. For instance, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, which supplies water to Klamath farmers, would determine if they need to install fish screens on their irrigation diversions and to help growers find funding. Other farmer-friendly parts of the original pact still need to go before Congress, which backers suspect will be more receptive now that the proposals don't include funding for dam decommissioning. And a federal court has rejected a challenge to suction dredge regulations in Oregon. In this story from Cascadia Wildlands, a federal court in Oregon has upheld an Oregon law restricting motorized gold mining in and along sensitive salmon streams. The District of Oregon Court held that the state of Oregon has the right to regulate both state and federal land to protect water quality and fish habitat, and has done so in a manner that does not conflict with federal law. The court correctly found that mining operations on federal land must comply with state laws enacted to protect public health and the environment, noted Roger Flynn, one of the Western Mining Action Project and one of the attorneys representing the conservation and fishing groups that joined the case to help defend the Oregon law. This decision supports a growing effort in Western states to protect clean water and fisheries from mining pollution and wildlife habitat damage, said Flynn. At issue is the case of Oregon's Senate Bill 838, passed in 2013, to implement temporary restrictions on equipment such as suction dredges and other motorized mining equipment in and nearby habitat essential for salmon and to protect water quality. The law went into effect this January and remains in effect through 2021. The 2013 law came about due to increasing concern throughout the state about the cumulative effects of these gold mining techniques on streams and rivers. With these protections, Oregon has taken the first step towards addressing threats to our salmon runs and water quality from mining, said Forrest English of the Rogue River Keeper. We look forward to sensible regulation that extends beyond 2021 and that ensures that these values are protected for all future Oregonians. The court has made it clear that we can do that. Peer-reviewed science shows that suction dredging can mobilize toxic mercury found in river bottoms and streams, as well as reduce salmon spawning success due to alterations in habitat. Additionally, in hot spots such as the Umpqua and Rogue Rivers, the number of dredges created conflicts with anglers and other recreationists. Oregonians can breathe a sigh of relief that many of our rivers and most sensitive salmon fisheries will be protected this summer from the toxic plumes of mercury that suction dredge mining releases, said Lori Ann Bird, Environmental Health Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. Gold miners brought a lawsuit against the state of Oregon last October, alleging that federal laws denied Oregon the right to protect environmental resources within the state. Environmental groups and commercial fishing interests, including Rogue River Keeper, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, Oregon Coast Alliance, Cascadia Wildlands, Native Fish Society, and the Center for Biological Diversity, intervene on behalf of the state and are represented by the Western Environmental Law Center and the Western Mining Action Project. We are very pleased the court has clarified that the state of Oregon has the power to protect our cherished rivers from destructive suction dredge mining, especially the famous Rogue River and its tributaries, one of the most important salmon rivers in Oregon, said Cameron La Follette with Oregon Coast Alliance. State environmental laws are a crucial means of protecting the public's investment in salmon habitat restoration in our public waterways. We are incredibly encouraged that the court made the common sense decision to permit Oregon to regulate harmful mining practices on some of Oregon's most cherished waterways, said Nick Cady with Cascadia Wildlands. Oregonians have the right to protect the things they value, including clean water and salmon. This decision will help keep Oregon's iconic wild salmon healthy for future generations, said Jay Crawford of the Native Fish Society. It bolsters similar protections in Oregon and Idaho, while giving Washington a path forward for protecting wild salmon and water quality from suction dredge mining. And you can find more information at the Cascadia Wildlands webpage, www.cascwild.org. That's cascwild.org. And turning to biologic diversity news, rare right whales get 40,000 square miles of protected habitat. Great news for the world's 500 remaining North Atlantic right whales. After years of legal work by the Center for Biological Diversity and other conservation groups, the National Marine Fisheries Service has protected 39,414 square miles of ocean as critical habitat for the whales. The rule protects areas of the Gulf of Maine, Georgia's Bank region, as well as calving grounds from southern North Carolina to northern Florida, but not the whales' twice-yearly migratory routes through the mid-Atlantic. North Atlantic right whales are being devastated by commercial whaling in the 18th and 19th centuries, and despite being federally protected as an endangered species since 1970, they haven't yet recovered. The new habitat protections are vital to help address long-standing threats to their persistence, including death and serious injury from ship strikes and entanglement in fishing gear. Right whales also increasingly face hazards from offshore energy development. Right whales are at an extinction crossroads right now, said Sarah Ulliman, a center senior attorney. The new rule takes critical steps by protecting the whales' northern feeding areas and southern calving grounds, but unfortunately it ignores the whales' migratory route between these two areas. And more than 7,000 acres of habitat have been protected for two Florida plants. More than 7,000 acres of critical habitat have been protected for two coastal plants in Florida, the Aboriginal prickly apple cactus and the Florida semaphore cactus. Critical habitat protection requires federal agencies to consult with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to ensure that federally funded or permitted actions won't damage or destroy the plant's habitat. The Aboriginal prickly apple cactus and the Florida semaphore cactus are threatened by sea level rise due to climate change, and if worst-case projections become a reality, these plants will likely need to be reintroduced to suitable higher elevation sites to escape extinction. The new habitat protections resulted from the center's historic settlement in 2011, requiring protection decisions for 757 plants and animals throughout the country. By protecting these plants now, we can plan for their future survival in upland habitats, said the center's Jacqueline Lopez. The service has done a great job of moving quickly to get these plants the protections they need to survive sea level rise. Management under the Endangered Species Act will ensure that these two beautiful and rare species will be around for generations to come. And the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies have filed a second legal challenge to the massive $1.7 billion freeway project in Southern California. The six-lane Mid-County Parkway would cut through low-income neighborhoods, threaten wildlife preserves, and worsen air pollution, bisecting the San Jacinto Valley and paving the way for more sprawling traffic in rural areas with a combination of agriculture, open space, and wildlife preserves. The valley, an important area for migratory birds, is home to numerous imperiled species, including burrowing owls, Swainson's hawks, tricolored blackbirds, willow flycatchers, and Stevens kangaroo rats. The new freeway would also force up to 396 residents from their homes and displace businesses that employ more than 170 people. Its environmental review notes that the chosen route would result in the highest impacts to residential relocations in areas with minority and low-income populations. This project will waste taxpayer dollars to destroy neighborhoods and wildlife areas with a polluting new freeway, said Jonathan Evans, legal director at the center's Environmental Health Program. There are smarter, safer, and cheaper 21st century transit solutions to solve existing traffic problems. And the red wolf population has plunged as feds gut their recovery program. New numbers show that the nation's only population of red wolves is in an alarming freefall, declining 27% from 2014 to 2015 to as few as 50 individuals. Just 4 years earlier, there were 100 wolves. Recently, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service bowed to political pressure from extreme anti-wildlife elements within the North Carolina state government, eliminating the program's recovery coordinator in 2014 and stopping the reintroduction of new red wolves into the wild in July of 2015. Director Ash and the Fish and Wildlife Service are deliberately condemning the red wolf to extinction, said the center's Brett Harty. The Red Wolf Recovery Program was once a shining example of successful conservation. Under the direction of Dan Ash, the program has been quietly dismantled to appease a few anti-wildlife zealots. It's disgraceful. More than 110,000 people from around the United States, including more than 1,500 North Carolina residents, have submitted letters in support of the Red Wolf Program. And you can find out more information at www.biologicaldiversity.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock. You can hear a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. In Moscow, Idaho, listen to KRFP Radio Free Moscow at 90.3 FM at 3 p.m. on Wednesdays. You can also listen to WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts, also on 90.3 FM. Truth and Justice Radio will air the Earth First Update sometime between 6 and 10 a.m. on Sundays. You can listen on the Internet at Grateful Dread Public Radio and Internet radio stations Sundays at 2 a.m. That's gdprnashville.org, gdprnashville.org. And you can also find them on tunein.com and spotify.com. You can also go to radioforall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First Updates. That's radio4all.net. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It's free to download. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. We want to thank you for listening and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.